It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out this week. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly check-in with Harry Enten of 538 to get the latest national political news. First, Democrat Hillary Clinton leads Republican Donald Trump 42-35% among registered voters in Wisconsin. That's according to the latest Marquette Law School poll released this afternoon. Charles Franklin joins us now to talk about these and other poll results as primary season comes to a close. He's a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Well, let's start with that presidential race. So the latest poll shows Hillary Clinton with 42% and Donald Trump with 35% support among Wisconsin registered voters. What kind of changes there?
Well, that's a little bit of a tightening among registered voters. It was a 10-point margin in March, our last poll, and now it's a 7-point margin. So that's not a lot of movement. It's a little bit of tightening.
And looking at likely voters, people who say they're definitely or intending to vote, what do you see there?
And this is the really interesting thing. With likely voters, the movement was actually the opposite direction. It was a 7-point margin in March, and it's now a 9-point margin for likely voters. What's going on is that between March and June, the expected turnout rate among Republicans dropped substantially from 87% saying they were certain they would vote down to 78%. For comparison, in June of 2012, it was 90%. Meanwhile, Democratic turnout actually went up slightly from 81 to 84%. So while registered voters look pretty much just like they did a month ago in terms of the balance between the parties, among likely voters, the electorate became a bit less Republican because of lower expected Republican turnout.
So if you
look, that has had the effect of likely voter numbers have moved in a Democratic direction, even as registered voter numbers have moved in a very slightly, but a little bit in a Republican direction.
Now, if you were to look elsewhere in the poll for a reason behind that shift that you're talking about, what do you see? Any clues there?
We see lots of division within the parties, and it affects both parties, though in somewhat different ways. Among Republicans, we asked, is the party united now, divided now, but it will unite, or will it not unite even by November? Fully 45% said they did not think their party would unite by November. Democrats are also divided, but it's 26% who think their party won't unite. And so that is one part of this. We're also seeing that among those who think the parties will remain divided, support for their party's nominee is particularly weak. Among Republicans that think they'll stay divided, only 63% are voting for Trump. Among Democrats who don't think the party will unite, 58% for Clinton. Both of those numbers would be typically 85 to 95% in a typical general election.
Now, you also looked at some of the hot-button issues, some would say scandals, depending on your political perspective, when you looked at both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. For Clinton, it was the email server while she was Secretary of State. For Donald Trump, it was his Trump University real estate seminars. Do people care about that? What kind of a sense did you get?
They seem to, and about equally. 61% said they were bothered by Clinton's email server. And 63% say they were bothered by Trump University. So about equal. 35% are bothered by both of those things. And then it's about equal between the email server and Trump U about the split. So this is something that crosses some party lines, and it does concern people. But it affects both candidates about equally right now.
Now, moving on to the U.S. Senate race in Wisconsin, we've got Democratic candidate Russ Feingold and Republican incumbent Ron Johnson. What's the latest on that race?
Well, here the race has tightened by just a percentage point from a 5-point Feingold lead to a 4-point lead among registered voters. But this, again, is where we see a pretty sharp difference with likely voters. In likely voters, Feingold had only a 3 percentage point lead in March. But with likely voters this month, it's 9 points. And so, again, you're seeing that the likely voters have, relatively speaking, fewer Republicans because of lower turnout. And that's affecting the Johnson-Feingold race a bit more than it's affecting the presidential race. This will be something that both parties will focus on, as turnout is so critical going into the fall. But where we are right now, there's some notable fall off for Republicans, and you can see the effect on the Senate race.
And Charles, in our last minute together, what did you see when you looked at how Wisconsinites felt about the direction the state was heading in, and also about Governor Scott Walker?
Yeah, the state of the state is a little pessimistic. 46% say we're headed in the right direction, but 50% say we're off on the wrong track. Also on the budget, 31% say the budget's better now than a few years ago, but more, 37%, say the budget's in worse shape. Those are two key indicators for the health of the state and how people are thinking about it. And the effect on Governor Walker's job approval is that his approval is at 39% approve, 57 disapprove. That's down from 43-53 in March, and means that the 39-57 now is pretty much where we saw it throughout most of 2015 and 2016 before March.
Well, Charles, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
That was Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. He joined us to talk about the results of the latest Marquette Law School poll released this afternoon. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, our guest explains why Wisconsin nursing homes and long-term care facilities are struggling to find qualified workers. Right now, it's time for our weekly look at the latest from the presidential campaign. Yesterday marked the last day of the primary season, with voters in the District of Columbia casting their ballots for the two remaining Democratic presidential hopefuls. Plus, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders met last night, and we'll find out what that might mean. Also, Donald Trump banned the Washington Post from access to his events. We'll talk about all that. Joining us now is Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538.com. Harry, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
How do you feel? The last primary is over.
Thank God. Thank God this is all over. We now have a general election campaign. We only have 5 more months to go. And once that happens, I plan on retiring to Hawaii for at least a month.
Well, you've earned it. What do you think about the results last night? Any surprise?
Not really. I mean, we all knew that the District of Columbia would be a primary that favored Hillary Clinton. It's chock full of African Americans, who she's done tremendously with, and well-educated white voters, who she's also done very well with. So she ends up winning by 60 points. It doesn't make a difference in the sense that she already has the majority of delegates necessary to, you know, get the nomination come convention time. But it's just a nice little finishing touch for her as we move into the general election.
Right, and on the heels of that win last night, Hillary Clinton met with Bernie Sanders privately for, I gather, nearly 2 hours. What do you think they talked about? What do you expect to come out of a meeting like that?
Well, they basically, you know, according to both campaigns, they both issued press releases that sounded very similar, in which, you know, Sanders is basically trying to ensure that his progressive platform is understood and incorporated to as much of a degree as possible by Hillary Clinton. Stuff like making college affordable, health care, just general stuff like that where they agree. And, you know, we'll see how much of it she incorporates. But, you know, I will say that there's a lot of talk wondering whether or not he overplayed his hand, insofar as that he obviously didn't do too well in primaries over the last few weeks, and Clinton's already got Obama's endorsement and Warren's endorsement, whether he should have folded earlier in hopes of getting her to capitulate more on some of these issues. But clearly he's going to go on for a little bit further and try and ensure that a progressive agenda is represented at the Democratic National Convention.
Do you see him capitulating anytime soon?
Not really. I mean, we thought that maybe on Thursday night he has this basically this town hall that he's going to be doing with people via video, and there was some, you know, some thought that maybe, you know, he would announce then that he was dropping out. But Reports are now that he won't. However, it's very clear that he knows that Hillary Clinton got more votes than he did and will be the nominee. They continue to say, we know who got the most votes. But, you know, essentially what they want to do is just continue on, perhaps being a little less negative, not talking about delegate counts, not trying to overturn the result, basically just trying to keep his name in the news and the issues that Bernie Sanders cares about in the news.
Well, I've been reading about some of the things he'd like by way of reform. He wants to address the what he sees as a problem with superdelegates. Also, he's looking for new leadership within the Democratic Party. How likely are those things looking to be picked up by Hillary as she goes forward?
I would be a little more cautious about that than perhaps others might. I mean, sure, there are some certain things like superdelegates that are mentioned, but those are liked by the establishment because it ensures them some power. Also, if you look, I think a lot of Republican insiders wish they had superdelegates because if the Republican system was the same as the Democratic system for selecting presidential nominees in terms of proportionality of delegates, not winner-take-all and superdelegates, then Donald Trump would be short of the 1237 instead of being well over. So he's going to fight for those. There's going to be some talk about it. There probably is going to be some talk about open primaries going forward, which is something that Bernie Sanders wants. But I would be cautious into thinking that those types of things will pass. But, you know, who knows? Maybe he'll be able to push enough buttons and say, hey, if you do this one little thing, I'll back you up tomorrow, Secretary Clinton, and maybe she'll do that. But for now, I'm a little cautious on thinking he'll have too much control.
You mentioned that you were wondering, or others have been wondering, whether Sanders had overplayed his hand, if he had folded earlier, whether he might have more receptivity for some of the things he's looking for. But on the other hand, we were just talking about the latest Marquette Law School poll, which is just out as of this afternoon, and both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, pretty high on favorables. In fact, at least in Wisconsin, Sanders does better there, and he also does better in a supposed matchup between Sanders and Trump, which doesn't look like it will happen. But in terms of overplaying his hand, he does have some strong numbers.
Sure, and you wouldn't hear me disagree with my good old friend Charles Franklin, who's a great pollster, and love Charles going all the way back. But you know, that same poll also found that Hillary Clinton was leading Donald Trump by 9 points. And that is without Bernie Sanders supporters or a good number of them backing Hillary Clinton. So if she gets those, she could go, you know, well in the double digits with her lead. But she is already winning the polls, both in Wisconsin and nationally. The national polls are widening. There was a Bloomberg poll yesterday, which, although was a bit of an outlier, still 12 percentage points. She was ahead. The average of polls has her up by about 5 or 6 points. That's wider than it was a few weeks ago. So Clinton's doing perfectly fine without Sanders. Now, certainly she would want his supporters to back her. But he's not in a position where he might have been a few weeks ago when those national polls were looking much closer to even. Now it's pretty clear that Clinton can win without those Sanders supporters, but getting them would be nice.
Now I want to talk a little bit about the horrible tragedy of this weekend, the Orlando shooting. And we've been covering that here in Central Time from a variety of angles, including safe spaces for the LGBT population. We'll be talking about the issue of hate and terrorism coming up. But in terms of politics, I hate to politicize it. It just happened. But you guys have been talking about how it could affect the election. Basically, I think you're saying we don't really know. But what do we know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, we wish that these types of things weren't politicized. But the fact is we have a presidential campaign going on and both candidates are articulating issues. So, you know, we wouldn't be doing our jobs if we weren't talking about it. Again, yeah, you're right. We don't really know. But I think what there was a lot of thought during the primary season that Donald Trump was his standing in the polls were helped by the San Bernardino and Paris attacks. You saw his numbers go up and he was more favored than the other Republican candidates were on those issues among Republican voters. But the one thing I would stress is that in a general election, in fact, those numbers don't look anywhere near as good for Trump. For instance, on handling an international crisis, Clinton's well ahead on the issue of terrorism. The two are basically tied, where Trump was well out ahead before. So, you know, essentially what I would say is let's wait and see. But the one thing I will say is we do know, we did see the CBS News poll that came out this morning, which showed that more Americans than not approved of the response by Hillary Clinton, while a majority did not approve of the response by Donald Trump. So right now it seems like Clinton is winning that battle, but we'll see in the days and weeks to go.
So we'll keep talking right now about Donald Trump. We just mentioned him there in his response to the attacks. He made news earlier this week talking about the Washington Post. He's revoked the press credentials for the Washington Post. What happened?
He just look, Donald Trump doesn't like bad press. He has revoked the press credentials of other people as well, BuzzFeed, for instance. This is something that he does. And, you know, the press was helped him out tremendously during the primary season. If you look, there was a report out this week that showed that Donald Trump received pretty much more favorable press coverage than any other GOP candidate, and not only just more, I mean not just the percentage, but so much more press. He received so much more, and in a multi-candidate field, getting a lot of press is very, very helpful because positions don't differ very much between the candidates. So the more you're in the ears and minds of voters, the better chance you have of winning. So all of a sudden we go to the general election, and now people are really, reporters are really digging into past statements of Trump, issuing stuff that's going on. And I think what Trump is also seeing are these general election polls, which I mentioned, they are widening. He sees a lot of bad press being thrown at him. And remember, it's not just the Washington Post that's digging up stuff. It's the New York Times, it's NBC News, it's pretty much everybody. And I think Trump is just very, very frustrated. But what I will say is that Robert Costa, who is one of the chief political writers over there at the Washington Post, who formerly wrote for conservative magazines, has been very fair. This idea that he's getting unfair press is ludicrous to me. It's just that the stuff that he says perhaps is not seen to be very nice by most of the American public, as the polls tend to indicate.
Does Donald Trump need the press? I mean, his camp has made the case that his Facebook reach, his Twitter reach is pretty huge, and maybe he can just go directly to the people.
I mean, his Twitter reach is huge. It's certainly bigger than mine, but again, most people aren't on Twitter. And, you know, most people aren't fans of Donald Trump on Facebook. That is, they're not receiving all of his posts. So he can talk around the press as much as possible. But he's not talking to most Americans, especially not most swing voters who, to be perfectly honest, probably are better off than all of us because they're not thinking about politics all the time. They're getting their news through their local news station or maybe the nightly news. And so to me, it's a folly to believe that you could simply get around these traditional news sources. Maybe in a primary where people are much more in tune to what's going on, you can rely more upon Twitter or Facebook. But in a general election, I just don't see that working. And I think if people were really listening to what Donald Trump's Twitter and Facebook page were saying, then Trump wouldn't be trailing in the polls right now with a widening lead for Hillary Clinton.
And from a media perspective, does the media need access? Does the Washington Post, for instance, need access to Donald Trump to be right there on the floor with the rest of the journalists to cover him? I saw a tweet from a Washington Post reporter. You know, they put out a piece on him and she said, look, we covered you without access. What do you think?
I mean, you don't need access. I mean, you can, you know, read the pool reports, for instance, that come out that are, you know, issued. You can watch his speeches on television or on radio. I think you gain a little bit more when you're there and you're in the hall and you understand what's going on and maybe you get some insider access and get a better understanding of what the candidate is exactly thinking and doing. But you don't need access, but I will say that it probably hurts the coverage a little bit. But more than that, if the campaign is not willing to talk with the reporters, it means that the reporters are only going to get one side, and it's not going to be the side of the issue that's Donald Trump's side. It's going to be the other side because other people will be talking. To me, it's a terrible idea to try and get better coverage. In fact, you'll probably get more negative coverage because of the people who will actually be talking to the reporters.
Looking at the relationship this election cycle between the candidates and the media, Chris Saliz, also from the Washington Post, pointed out that Hillary Clinton hasn't done a press conference in quite a while in a way that spoke to him. What do you think? Is there something different or transformational happening this election cycle between the candidates and the media?
I mean, Hillary Clinton almost, you know, doesn't really trust the press for any number of reasons, rightfully or wrongfully. I'd say wrongfully, to be honest, to stick up for my fellow press members. But she's never done that. She's relied more upon, you know, ads and maybe talking to specialty radio and television programs. That's something that Barack Obama frequently does. He gets criticized, for instance, on going on Fallon while not talking, you know, to quote-unquote serious reporters. But I would say what made Donald Trump so unique was that he did all of this press. He called in the CNN. He appeared on CNN. He appeared on Fox. He appeared on Morning Joe. He appeared on all these programs. He gave himself, part of the reason he got unlimited press access was because he was willing to put himself out there. And I thought that was a positive for his campaign. Now, all of a sudden, he's not doing that. So he's not getting all of this free press that he once did, or at least the free positive press that he once did. And Hillary Clinton is going to be able to go more on par with him than any of his GOP primary competitors were. And to me, it's not a smart move, and I don't think it's particularly good either for the quote-unquote republic for both of our candidates not to be willing to go to the press. But keep in mind, it's not like President Obama's offering a lot of press either, and most Americans seem to like the job he's doing, so I don't want to overstretch how big of a deal this is, but I would say it's not a good thing.
Now, you and Nate Silver had a conversation about why battleground states like Wisconsin have been so seemingly stable in recent elections, and if that could change. What do you think? This has been a wildly unpredictable election season. Do you think things could change there?
Sure. I mean, what we know, what our conversation was essentially about was, hey, in the past few cycles, the both parties have selected candidates who are fairly safe. They're fairly generic candidates. And so there's not any real way that they shake up the map, especially as partisanship has become stronger and stronger and stronger. Republicans vote for Republicans and Democrats vote for Democrats. But Donald Trump is not a traditional candidate by any other name. I mean, he's just not. And in fact, if you look at a state like Wisconsin, you know, you look at that Marquette poll, Hillary Clinton was up 9 among likely voters. She hasn't led by anything less than 9 in any poll published this entire cycle in the state of Wisconsin. I just, unless something dramatically changes, Wisconsin, which, you know, has been a fairly swing state, although carried by Democrats since 88, you know, Bush came close to winning it both in 2000, 2004. Unless something changes, I just don't see how it's going to be all that competitive. While states like Arizona and maybe Georgia could, for Clinton, which were lost by President Obama by fairly wide margins, could become more competitive. But we'll see down the line as these campaigns really get underway. We'll see if these states that look like they were swinging don't end up being, while those states that were more traditionally swingy do end up being true swing states once again.
Well, Harry, thanks a lot, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you so much.
That is Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. He joins us every week at this time to talk about the latest in national politics. Coming up after the news, we talk about what's behind the shortage of caregivers in Wisconsin. Our guest says we are at a crisis level when it comes to that shortage. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out this week. Coming up, what phenomena led to the Orlando shooting? We talked to a guest who believes it's political, cultural, and technological changes. First, a recent report says that the state is facing a crisis-level shortage of long-term care workers like CNAs and nursing home staff. The report comes from a coalition of provider associations here in Wisconsin and states that 1 in 7 caregiver positions in nursing homes and assisted living facilities are currently vacant. Experts say low pay is a major reason behind the shortage, and these low numbers have a major effect on who can get care. John Sauer is with us now. He's the president and CEO of Leading Age Wisconsin, one of the organizations that worked on this report. John, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
It's good to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, first off, tell us why you decided to look at what you did here. What were you going after?
Well, we wanted to document the depth of what we knew to be a workforce crisis, but we didn't want to do it just simply anecdotally. And so our board of directors that work for a nonprofit board, we went through a strategic planning process as we do every 2 years. And 2 years ago, workforce wasn't one of the top three issues. Alternative payment systems, changing delivery systems, how we're providing care, changes within the continuum really populated the top three. In 2015, we did a survey of our members, and every response came back that workforce is the number one concern that the long-term care provider community has. And we weren't alone. Other associations had the same kind of conversations with their boards. And so we embarked on together what I think is the largest survey of residential and skilled care providers in the state of Wisconsin. We had over 700 responses to that survey. And that's where the conclusion came out, it was documented that we have a 14, almost 15% vacancy rate for caregivers in our facilities. And we found that working with other other community-based organizations, we found that they also had a shortage of caregivers.
Why do you think this emerged as a number one issue so quickly?
Well, I think it was organizations have done everything they can to kind of patch things through year after year, and now it's just coming to a head. Part of it is the demographics are such that there's more and more demand for the services that caregivers provide. So from 2010 to 2025, that trend continues, and we're going to see 140% increase in the number of individuals over age 85 in our state. And so over the age 85. So what we're seeing, that also is a trend that developed some number of years ago. And the demand keeps going up, and we need more caregivers to meet the demand of our aging population.
140% increase is a huge increase. Are other states seeing similar increases, or is Wisconsin unique there?
Wisconsin's in the more the upper tier of the aging population. Our mobility, out-migration is not as great as some other states, and so we do have a pretty significant over the age of 65 population, which is going to double in the next 30 years. So the over age 85 population is one that really gets our attention, because if you drive around the state and you visit a continuing care campus, a nursing home with housing and assisted living and other services, by and large, you're going to find that the average age of the individual living there is 85 years of age. That's the population that has said it's either a need or a want. They need skilled nursing care. They can no longer live independently. They need the assistance offered by a facility-based organization. Or it's just that they may not feel safe. They're having trouble with nutrition. They can't maintain their own home. So it's the over age 85 population that really needs the services offered by caregivers. And again, one in seven caregiving positions in the state is vacant.
What have you discovered in your report about why that is? Is it just that the population is booming, or are people actually leaving the profession or not going into it?
Well, and some of it is economics. Actually, a great deal of it is economics. We don't put all of the blame on that, but the reality is, as a society, as a nation, we don't really have a long-term care funded system. We don't have an insurance system, say, like Germany or other countries might have. And so when someone's needs are such that they need attention of the skilled nursing facility, of physicians, others, for a long-term care stay, that tends to deplete their income rather quickly, the resources they have to pay for the care, obviously under a fixed income. And so we have two-thirds of everyone in a nursing home, for example, dependent on government payments, generally through the Medicaid program. And so since Medicaid payments have lagged significantly in terms of the cost of care, that has really caught up to the provider community, where the losses that were incurred for serving people on Medicaid are just stopping or preventing providers from being able to offer higher wages and benefits to caregivers. What we're saying is if the Medicaid program paid higher reimbursement rates, the provider community would be able to pay caregivers more. And since payments lag, that's a dilemma that we have.
And some reports I've seen show that Wisconsin is among the worst systems in the nation when it comes to Medicaid reimbursement. Do you know why that is?
Well, there was a national study, and it looked at 33 states that they had data for, and Wisconsin came out as the worst state in the country, of those 33 at least, of having Medicaid losses of about $55 per day per resident. So what that means in the nursing home, and this gets back to if those losses are so great, how do we pay for caregivers? If you're in a private pay resident in a nursing home in Wisconsin and you are there for 30 days, you are going to pay $3,000 more a month then Medicaid pays for the same care. So there's this not-so-hidden tax where private pay people are paying far more than they should have to because Medicaid is not. And so, you know, at best, facilities look at, you know, how do we break even? But really their cost shifting is because we don't have the dollars, because Medicaid doesn't pay its share. It falls back on, well, then how do we maintain our budget? How do we stay in business? And what we've seen is organizations have tried to do the best they can in offering wages and benefits and hours, but our survey really indicates that we're slipping. We're just not able to maintain that. There's about 11,000 vacant positions in caregiver positions in Wisconsin. And what we're saying is Medicaid is going to have to step up and realize, you know, they're part of the problem. We're doing what we can collectively to look at training, mentorship programs, high school apprenticeship programs, and other ways to attract people into this field, because it is a rewarding, fulfilling, difference-making career. But we can't expect people to stay in long-term if non-healthcare, non-long-term care positions are going to be able to offer far more in the ways of wages and benefits.
We're talking with John Sauer right now, president and CEO of Leading Age Wisconsin. His company was part of a recent study that shows a shortage of long-term care workers in Wisconsin. And not just a shortage, it is crisis level by some measures. And John, we've been talking about this in the big picture, but can you take it down to the personal level for us and tell us some stories about how this impacts people and their families?
Well, we have visited with our providers. We visited with families. My mother lives in an assisted living facility in Wisconsin, so I know some personal stories. And not to get too personal, but what we've seen is we had an assisted living provider open up, and they were providing high acuity assisted living. That means the people in this assisted living facility, for the most part, were at least a level of nursing home care. And so it was a new organization. They opened it up, and they had to turn down admissions. There were people lining up saying, this is the kind of care that I need in my community, but the organization simply could not staff the facility. So they've had to really slow down and be very selective about who they're admitting. We've also found, in our survey, that there's we estimate about 5,000 people who have been denied access to a facility when they needed care because, again, I had a nursing home administrator say to me yesterday that he will close down part of the nursing home before he accepts someone for whom they're unable to care. So that means if they don't have the staff, they're not going to admit people, and what we're starting to see is, you know, an access issue in the state of Wisconsin.
We're speaking with John Sauer, again, president and CEO of Leading Age Wisconsin, talking about a crisis-level shortage of caregivers in Wisconsin. And you can join the conversation on this, too. Have you been affected by the shortage of caregivers in your life here in Wisconsin? And if you work in a nursing home or an assisted living facility, have you noticed a shortage of CNAs and other staff? Are you someone who's worked in that field? What is it like, and what do you think might need to change? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll be back with more on this in just a little bit. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're talking about a reported shortage of caregivers here in Wisconsin. And you can join our conversation, too. Has this affected your family, maybe a parent or a grandparent? If you've worked in this profession, what is it, do you think, that is causing the shortage? Is it the pay that you see? Is it the hours? Is it other things? Call us, 800-642-1234. John Sauer is with us now. His organization, Leading Age Wisconsin, worked on the report that says Wisconsin is facing a crisis-level shortage of caregivers. And let's take our first call right now. We've got Linda on the line with us in Madison. Linda, hi.
Hi, my dad just turned 86. My mom is 80. He had an injury to his esophagus many years ago, so it's constricted, and he needs to have food that is almost like baby food. He's been in a couple different regional nursing homes, but it's always had temporary because the staff, from dietary to caregivers, could not provide him with the food he needed, and he'd lose weight, and my mom would get frustrated and angry and take him back out and have him at home, which he is now, and her health isn't that much better either. So we're seeing it firsthand.
Linda, thank you so much for sharing that story, and I'm sorry for what your family has gone through. And John, what do you think when you hear a story like that? How does that reflect back on this caregiver shortage, too?
Well, I think that's part of the reality. I would say that we're doing this delicate balance of being a very, very direct by coming out with a study about the workforce crisis, realizing that what we don't want people to do is to lose hope in the long-term care delivery system. But we need to have some honesty in these conversations, and that's why we came out with a report. You know, I think what Linda is talking about is, you know, someone who needs a special diet, pre-ed food, and it is somewhat specialized with swallowing assessments, et cetera. Our hope is that that, you know, care can be provided to people at that level. But I think if the facility feels like they're unable to meet that person's needs, then we think it's better to look at other options. I will say, though, that the quality of care in Wisconsin, I want to say this very clearly, is among the highest in the country. So there are clinical indicators, quality measures published by the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. And I just looked at the short-term admissions or short-term stays in nursing homes. And there are 9 indicators, and Wisconsin was exceeded the national average in 8 out of 9. So I think if you talk to the regulatory community or the ombudsman, we have excellent ombudsman, which is the advocacy state agency for nursing home residents. I think they would tell you, because they've certainly told us and our members, that we have among the finest nursing homes in the state of Wisconsin. And I would say the same thing about our assisted living facilities. The reality is that as people need more care, I think we're going to see people who perhaps stay in the hospital longer than perhaps, you know, they need to, because it's just difficult to find organizations that are fully staffed and able to care for people of higher and higher needs.
Well, thank you so much, Linda. Appreciate that. And let's go next to Deb calling from Vesper. Deb, hi.
Hi. My comment is I have a daughter that works in this field, I guess I'll say. And, I think a lot of the problem is the hours. It's very seldom is it full-time. The pay is not there. I think the more that we have a county-run nursing home, it's running very well. The longevity is great. The workers stay there for years because they have the benefits. They have the hours. These other ones that are privatized, they go for profit, and the workers, there's turnover, a high turnover all the time. We need better working conditions for these people to entice them to stay in here and give them longevity and a way of life.
Deb, thank you so much for that perspective. Deb's daughter working in that industry is saying there's some very clear things she sees as being barriers to longevity, the hours and the benefits.
Right, and that's I think, what our workforce study says and what our comments about the Medicaid reimbursement system be about the worst in the country. We do have data that shows that as organizations are able to pay higher wages, benefits, and have higher staffing, their turnover is less. But we have a system, a payment system, that really says we're going to pay far less than the cost of care, far less than even the average cost of care. And again, the nursing home payment system says we're going to have, for every Medicaid person you serve, you're going to lose $55 per resident per day. So it is, you know, it is the great challenge is how do we become that home that Deb talked about that has those higher wages and benefits and hours when we are so dependent on government payments? You know, generally speaking, some organizations that have those kind of those higher payments might have a higher private pay mix, a higher Medicaid mix, Medicare mix, or county subsidy. What we're saying for all facilities that are suffering by inadequate payments, we need a payment system that is fair, predictable, and says we're not going to gravitate to the lowest possible wage for caregivers. We're going to instead start with what is an adequate or, you know, at least adequate wage for caregivers, and let's try and get a funding system that does that.
We're talking with John Sauer right now from Leading Age Wisconsin, talking about a crisis-level shortage of long-term caregivers here in the state of Wisconsin. We've got a lot of folks wanting to talk to you, John, but just briefly, one change that is on the horizon, the state will be moving to an independent assessment model for Medicaid recipients later this summer. And it sounds like this will give a private company the power to evaluate and decide how many hours of care a client will receive. Now, what do you think about that change and what it could do?
Well, that is a program for personal care services. So it's outside of the payment system for nursing homes and outside the payment system for skilled care. But what it is, I believe, attempt by the state is to say, let's do an independent assessment. Let's look at the needs that people have, and let's look at make sure that the care and services are being provided appropriately and paid for appropriately. It's controversial within the personal care delivery system about whether or not the agency can do a better assessment than an independent organization. But in the end, it comes down to what is our payment level. Let's just focus on those people who need long-term care and services. Let's focus on them getting the care at the right place at the right time, and then talk about payment level. In other words, we believe that if there are many options for skilled nursing care today with family care and other options, and the people who are in nursing homes today need to be there. And so we're beyond the debate about whether or not they need to be there. If anyone like our family has had loved ones in a nursing home, you need them when you need them, and we have to look at adequately staffing and adequately paying for the caregivers.
Let's go back to our callers now. Chris joins us next in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I just wanted to call in and say, you know, in contrast to the previous caller, you know, I work for a nonprofit organization, and we do community supported living for elderly individuals, developmental disabilities, all pretty much the whole gamut from, you know, I've had clients 6 years old to 92. So we pretty much help everybody out. And, you know, we pay well above minimum wage. And it's still hard to keep people, you know, it's hard to keep that turnover low. And it is, you know, I'm a manager in the company, and it's just very difficult. And so I always hear the pay thing, but we do pay pretty well. And one thing I think that, you know, companies could probably do to help on reducing that burnout, and something that we have is, you know, once you get hired, you know, all you need is a high school diploma. And, you know, right out of the gate, you've got 3 weeks vacation. And that's something that they do. And unfortunately, we hire, you know, people, and given the profession, a lot of times they care so much, people don't always use that. So, I mean, I feel like it's kind of my job. I have to ride a lot of my employees to get them to take their time off.
Chris,
you know, it's difficult.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I appreciate that. Another great perspective there. He's saying his organization does pay people a lot, but they still lose people, have a hard time retaining. Some of that might be burnout for him.
Right. You know, it is a 24/7 job caring for people. And what I also said before is it's not all just economics. It is how we treat people, how we provide career ladders, how we reward people, even non-economic recognition. And so I think we have to do our part together as a society, as a provider community, to say how do we have this be where we treat people who are in an honorable profession and they have selected to work in this area. So it's not just all economics. We need to do more support, more flexibility in staffing, lifestyle choices, you know, et cetera. We just need to really say we're gonna not do it the old traditional way, but we're do everything we can to support the caregiving community.
And in our last couple seconds here, are you hopeful that we can change and change quickly enough?
Well, I think we have to. I think, you know, muddling through this is not going to prepare us for that 140% increase in the over age 85 population that's coming to us.
John, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks for inviting me. Thank you.
That was John Sauer talking about the state's shortage of caregivers for nursing home and assisted living facilities. He's a CEO of Leading Age Wisconsin. Coming up next, we talk to a global affairs expert who says that technology, politics, and social changes led to the shooting in Orlando. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to Central Time right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We deal with a lot of books here at Wisconsin Public Radio, and most of the people who work here are people who are really into books. The Central Time team, by the way, takes it a step further. They're even into the way books smell. Here's two of our excellent producers, J.C. Larson and Matt Olson, to tell us more. Hey, guys.
Hey, Veronica.
Hi, Veronica.
So the production office where you guys both work, you have created a best smellers list, not best sellers, best smellers. How did you come up with that?
Yeah, so here at Wisconsin Public Radio, we get a ton of advanced copy books from publishing houses to see if we would like to talk about the book on the show, have the author in, and I personally love the smell of books. So every time I open up one of those packages, I leaf through it, I look at the information, and then I have a smell.
So you guys are in there sniffing books.
We are in there sniffing books. Frequently, anyone passing by the office can see this. And it just sort of was born out of both of us realizing that we were smelling the books. And we found one book in particular, our number one.
Best smeller is
First Dads by Joshua Kendall. And it has been the standard bearer. And spoiler alert, he's going to be on with us this week to talk about that book. Unrelated, but
not because it smells good.
Not because it smells good. It's just a perk.
So what do you like about it in 2 seconds or less?
You know, sometimes you just know.
We just know.
All right, guys. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about best smellers on Wisconsin Public Radio.